We move forward to the period of the second Beit HaMikdash. We just had the story of Zechariah and the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. We move forward to the second Beit HaMikdash. Our sages say, the first Beit HaMikdash, there was Gilui Arayot. There was Shfichut Tamim. There was Avodah Zarah. There was murder. There was idol worship. An illicit relationship. There was also men sleeping with men. There were terrible things going on in Israel in the period of the first Beit HaMikdash until the destruction. Now we move forward to the second Beit HaMikdash period. So in the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, people were learning Torah. People were arrogant. There were people who adopted the lifestyle of the Epicureanists. They said, let's enjoy life. They were very into enjoying life all the time. But people were also very learned in Torah. Why was the second Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Our sages say, Sinat Chinam. There was baseless hatred. When one Jew saw another Jew who was different than him in the worship of Hashem, so then he looked at him and he'd say, you're an apikores. You're a person who's not accepted within the Jewish people. So we know there are limitations to what's considered Jewish and not. But within those limitations, there's a lot of room for color. And so in this period of the second Beit HaMikdash, where we did not have Nevi'im, we did not have prophets, and this was a hardship for us, because until that point, the Navi would tell a person, this is the way you should serve Hashem. And every person would go to a Navi, and the Navi could guide him as to what was right in his Avodas Hashem. You develop your skills in Tefillah, you develop your skills in Chesed, you develop your skills in Torah. Every person was given a path to follow by the Navi. But in the second Beit HaMikdash, if a person says, you know, I have to work on having a soup kitchen, people would look at him and say, you're not showing up to shul enough, buddy. Then the next guy would show up to shul and they'd say, you're not spending enough time in the base medrash. And every person felt justified sending up his metric system and looking at others and saying, you don't live up to my standards. You're not kosher. And people were disqualifying one another. We've been faced with this challenge since the destruction, since the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. And so the second Beit HaMikdash brought us into an era where we were very good at learning Torah. We were also very good at judging other people for their values and not having room within our Judaism for people who did things a little different than us. And again, there's definitely a boundary. No one argues that Korach stepped out of the boundary. No one argues that the Karaites stepped out of the boundaries. But within the boundaries, there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room for a lot of color. And there must be respect. Respect doesn't mean I'm willing to put up with you. Respect means you can be right and I can be right. People ask me sometimes, how can you eat by so-and-so's house? I say, they're a good kosher Jew. I'm sure they checked out what they do. And then they say, yes, but you in your house, you only eat A, B, C, and D. And maybe they're eating A, B, C, D, and E, and F. Maybe they eat things that you wouldn't eat. They eat kashruyot that you don't rely on. So my answer is, maybe they're right. It's true. Maybe they're doing something different than me, but maybe they know better than me. Who says I'm right? I do my homework, I do my research, and based upon that, we try to run our home. But that doesn't mean I'm right. Means I've done my responsibility, and based on that we run our home. He's done his responsibility, based on that he runs his home. What's my problem eating by him? If he's a good kosher Jew and he tries to do what's right, so who said I'm doing more right than him? Maybe he's doing more right than me. Accepting color means it's not that I can live with you that you're different, it's that I respect that I could be right and you can be right. There's room for both of us, even if we're different, and there's room for both of us to be right. It's not that I can handle him. I can deal with that. I'll be willing to daven in the same shul as him. No. It's that he might be wonderful and I'll be wonderful and the next guy's wonderful and we're all different. So the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed over Sinat Chinam, baseless hatred, and we've had that challenge ever since. The Talmud tells us all kinds of stories about the period of the second Beit HaMikdash. We have the stories of the rabbis saying, don't fight with the Romans. And the people wouldn't listen to the rabbis. The rabbis said, you're not going to win. And the people wouldn't listen to them. The rabbi said, okay, we have a siege, but we have enough food to hold on to it. But you had the Sakharikin. You had people who would walk around with stilettos, with these knives that they could hide inside their sleeve. And if they thought you weren't faithful to their cause, and there were many causes in Jerusalem at the time, then they'd walk by a person in the marketplace and stab him without anyone seeing who stabbed him. They'd walk away and suddenly you'd see the man bleeding to death. So this wasn't Arabs stabbing Jews. This was Jews stabbing Jews. And people were scared because they could be walking into the marketplace, and if the Sakharikin thought that you weren't fighting the Romans enough, then a person would find himself dead. Now, it reached a point where the leader of the Sakharikin realized that everything was doomed, and he said, but I can't, if I tell the people we better give up our fight, they'll kill me. And he didn't know how to stop it. And things broke up into factions. And the rabbis kept saying, you're not going to win. But they weren't listened to. And so we enter an era where the Romans are a huge force. And they're very organized. And they don't even send their whole army to Israel. They have armies throughout the Middle East. And they don't need to send the whole army. And they're going to defeat us. And we don't have an organized army. We haven't had an organized army. We've never needed an organized army. Because from the time of the Hasmoneans, we've had treaties with the Romans. And when there were fights among the Hasmoneans, they went off to Rome and said, you guys rule between us. Who's going to... Who should be the king? And when you had fights, infighting, when two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, were fighting between themselves. You guys know the story, right? Their father left message. We learned this in Jewish history. There was Chonio. Chonio was very learned. And Chonio, when his father passed away, he was the younger brother. His father said, the next Kohen Gadol should be my son Chonio. So Chonio told his big brother, he said, you're the older one, you be the Kohen Gadol, I don't want to usurp you. And then he decided, I shouldn't have done that. So he goes back to his older brother, who knew nothing, not too much about Judaism. And he says, on the day that they appoint you as Kohen Gadol, part of the ritual is, you show up in your wife's nightgown. Your wife has almost a see-through nightgown. That's how you're supposed to show up for inauguration day. And then on inauguration day, his older brother shows up in his wife's nightgown. And he tells all the rabbis, he says, you see, he told his wife he would prove his dedication to her by showing up to do the service on the first day in her nightgown, to show he's more dedicated to her than anything. So the rabbis come in and they're ready to kill him. And the brother says, what did I do? And they look at him and they realize they shouldn't kill him. There's something wrong here. And they ask him, what happened? Why'd you do this? Why'd you show up in your wife's clothing to do the service? And he says, Chonio told me that's what I'm supposed to do. So they start questioning him and they uncover the whole story. So Chonio runs away because they're ready to kill Chonio. And kill over here means literally kill. So Chonio runs away to Egypt. And he sets up a temple in Egypt. Here's a story of a fight between brothers. Baseless hatred. Chonio could have been the Kohen Gadol. No, he's going to bury his brother. And then you have Hyrcanus and Aristobulus who are fighting over their father's throne. If you read Josephus, you read about kings from the Herodian dynasty who are killing their whole family out for fear maybe they're trying to take my throne. Not exactly. Not exactly. So we go down a period in our history where our own kings were killing out whole cities and whole towns, right and left. and the Romans come in. And for a period, the Romans are decent. And then the Romans establish governors that make decrees that are very hard on the Jews. No keeping Shabbos, no circumcising, right? The Romans have a uniform law for everyone. It's part of their fairness. And honestly, they want it to be fair to everyone. They want everyone to be Roman citizens. And so the Jews are forbidden from circumcising and keeping Shabbos. And then the Roman governor, who's present, who is evil, who is interested in hurting the Jews, starts making decrees that make it much, much worse. He starts taxing them unfairly, ruling unfairly, and insisting that every girl that gets married has to spend their first night with him, and he keeps making more and more decrees till the Jews see they can't stand it. And they kill him. And now they are arousing the wrath of Rome against them. And the rabbis keep insisting, go talk to the Romans, you can get somewhere, but the Jews won't listen. Who doesn't listen? People who think they stand to gain. All kinds of hooligans who thought that by leading a rebellion they would win. The rabbis understood that there was no way. We weren't equipped, we weren't powerful enough, we couldn't win. But these hooligans said, there are rebellions brewing throughout the Middle East. The time is ripe. If we join the rebellions, then we can free ourselves of Roman rule. Yes? Who said the Bar Kokhba revolt was right? Rabbi Akiva made a mistake.
It was a mistake.
That's what the Rambam writes. You're right. The Bar Kokhba revolt, historians claim, from Talmud I'm not clear on this, but historians claim that the great destruction of Israel was with the Bar Kokhba revolt, not with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. That's what historians claim. The masses were killed with Bar Kokhba's revolt. We group them all together. It's not so clear. We have a question in our calendar. During the time of the destruction, we're not clear on how many years passed between the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and Bar Kokhba. When did these things actually take place? I'm saying Rabbi Akiva was around. Rabbi Yeshua was still around. I'm saying, we say Rabbi Akiva only started learning at age 40. And yet Rabbi Akiva is learned enough to be talking to, and Rabbi Akiva dies at age 120.
Finishes learning at 80, right?
Okay. That leads to many questions. Historically, we have a problem.
On the note of Beit Kofonio, Rashi, when it talks about when Sancheriv's army dies, so he says that there's a machloket, so Chizkiyahu frees all the slaves. So he says, one opinion is that there's a pasuk about the non-Jews bringing sacrifices. One opinion is that it was the slaves that Chizkiyahu, and the other opinion that it was Beit Fonio. So in there it seems like Beit Fonio was a positive thing.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm saying here it's being described as a negative thing, which okay. Is the general description of it. I'm saying
so machlokas and the Gemara. Two opinions as to whether Beit Fonio was a Beit HaMikdash in the name of Hashem, or Beit Avodah Zarah, or there's another opinion that says it began in the name of Hashem and it evolved into Beit Avodah Zarah. So the Romans try to make treaties with us, and we turn back on the treaties. There's one time where the Jews tell the Romans, we'll make peace with you, and so the Romans come and we surprise attack them. Great. What did we accomplish? What we accomplish is that the Romans are far more cruel to us. The Romans, at that point, they almost lose their general. Initially Vespasian, and then he appoints his son Titus when he is appointed emperor. So Vespasian has to go back to Rome, and he appoints his son Titus, who is very evil, to lead the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, they laid a siege on Jerusalem. Technically, we had enough food. Technically, we also had water. They had developed underground waterways where they had water in Jerusalem. So they could have outlasted the siege. Our tradition is that the Romans would have broken after 21 years. Had we held on the 21 years for which we were equipped, the Romans would have given up. So the only reason the Beit HaMikdash fell was because there was infighting. In Jerusalem, the people were fighting against one another, destroying one another's crops, to the point where we starved ourselves to death. We lost the war. The Romans would send word into Israel, come out and live. And so that worked for a time until the hooligans inside said, we want to make peace, we want to come out with you. They came out as though they were making peace with the Romans. And then They drew swords and killed the Romans. And then the Romans said, okay, now we can't accept anyone in peace anymore. And from that point onward, Jews were in great, they were in danger from both sides. When Jews would leave the city of Jerusalem, they were in danger of being killed by Jews for leaving Jerusalem. They were in danger of being killed by Romans. When Romans discovered that the Jews would swallow jewels and money in order to take it with them, so that when the Romans would catch them, they seemed like they had nothing. So then the Romans developed a cruel way of killing Jews. They'd find a Jew, they'd punch him in the stomach, grab his stomach, and pull out his intestines. The Jews were so emaciated that they could actually kill them that way. Punch, grab, pull out, and the Jew died, and then they'd start searching through his stomach to see if there was any money left. Inside Jerusalem, if you were caught with a loaf of bread or a slice of bread, that was punishable by death. The Sakrikin would go house to house, searching, if people had more than their rations, if they had food, if you looked healthy. Then they said, you're obviously hiding food. And they'd either torture or kill the person searching their house for food. In Jerusalem, they tried to bury the dead. And they had underground ways where the Jews would sometimes hide. As happened in the destruction, many of the Jews were able to hide under the streets. Well, there were Jews hiding in a cave. And they had nothing to eat. So the group in the cave said, let's send someone out to bring us something to eat. At least find a corpse, bring us that to eat, bring us something. So one young man said, fine, I'm going out. So he went out of the cave, everyone stayed inside. He went out and he finally found the body. He rolls over the body, he looks and he sees it's his own father. So he says, I can't do this. He digs a grave, buries his father, and comes back to the cave and says, I couldn't find anyone. So someone else in the group says, okay, then I'm going out, I'll go looking. So they all wait in the cave, and he comes back with a bunch of meat, and he says, I found the body, and they're all eating. And as they're eating, the first guy who went out, he says to him, you know, I went out, I didn't see any bodies, what did you find? And he says, oh, you're right, I didn't find any body either, but I found a fresh grave, and so I dug it out, and that's what I brought, the body I found there. And so our sages say that was a fulfillment of one of the curses. Hashem says that when the Jewish people transgress, they will find themselves eating the flesh of their own parents. Not only parents eating their children, this is one of the fulfillments of the curses that happened at the destruction. Our sages tell us, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Yishmael, the Kohen Gadol, was very, very beautiful. And so when it was his turn to be executed, the emperor's daughter heard from the window, she heard the yelling outside, she went and she looked and she said, he's so beautiful, I want you to save him for me, Dad, let me have him. He said, no, I have to kill him. So she said, then give me his flesh. And so they said, fine, skin him to death. And so they brought these big things like peelers, like these massive peelers, and they started skinning his face to death. And as they're skinning him, he doesn't say a word until they reach the point of his tefillin, and at that point he let out a yell, and with that yell he passed away.
What does that mean? Does his beauty, so he had nice skin, so he peeled it to death?
They peeled it off, and then they put it on a mummy, and she had it in her room, as though she had his face there. What? I don't know. So the Kohen Gadol's son and daughter, one Roman purchased the boy and another Roman purchased the girl. And so they came back to Rome and they started talking to one another. So one Roman says to the other, he says, you wouldn't believe what a fine lad I brought back from Jerusalem. The most beautiful fine specimen of humanity I ever saw. His eyes are shining like stars. His skin is soft as velvet. He is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And the other one says, oh, but you can't imagine what I brought back from Israel. I brought a girl, her locks of hair are the most gorgeous you've ever seen. Those eyes, they're emeralds. I'm telling you, the most beautiful ever. You can't imagine. So they said, you know what, why don't we pair them up? And then we'll split the proceeds, the children they'll have. You'll take half as slaves and I'll take half as slaves. We'll both benefit. Great idea. So that night, they put in the boy. They brought the boy into the room. They sat him down in a corner and they said, we're bringing you your wife. And then they brought the girl in and they closed the door and the lights are out and they both walked home happy. The two are sitting there. So the boy sits in a corner and he starts crying. And he says, I'm a grandson of Aaron, a Kohen. How could it be that I, a Kohen, a descendant of Kohanim Gdolim, I'm going to go with a maid? They're putting me to marry a maid? How could it be, Rabon Shom, I'm a Kohen? And he sits in the corner sobbing. He says, Rabon Shom, I want to be your holy servant. I don't want to marry a maid to be a servant to a Roman. And he sits there in the corner crying. She thinks the same thoughts. She's sitting at the other end of the room and she starts crying and she says, Rabon Shalom, you brought me to a family of holy people. I grew up holy. I tried to keep your Torah. I'm a descendant of Aaron. How could I marry a slave? Let me be your servant. Marry a slave? She spends the night crying, he spends the night crying. All night long, each one's in their corner. And as the day starts coming and it starts getting light, they turn around and they see one another and they realize it's one another, their siblings. And they embrace and they weep together and they both pass away in one another's embrace. So that's a second story we have that's quoted through the keynote of Tisha B'Av. Third story. Third story.
Did it say that they passed?
It says they passed. Could be from a heart attack. I don't know. It says they died in sorrow. It says that the Romans were very into molesting boys. When Romans would go to war, they would often take young boys with them to sleep with them at night. This was a common practice by the Romans. This was even Plato speaks about it as the finest form of love. And so the Romans at the end of the war gathered 300 boys and 300 girls, and their idea was to fill their brothels with boys and girls. They used both. And so they were on the ship. And the boys were trying to figure out, are we supposed to jump overboard and die, or rather than be taken to the Roman brothels? And they were having this conversation between them. As they were talking about it, the girls jumped overboard and committed suicide. They said, we won't lead lives like this. The boys said to one another, they were taken to do natural activity and they jumped overboard. We're being taken to do something unnatural. We should definitely learn from them. And they jumped overboard. And about them, David HaMelech says in Tehillim, we call to you Hashem from the depths of the waters. Am Yisrael, in spite of all the decrees, tried to stay faithful to their Ribono Shel Olam. And the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, with all its tragedies, we lost probably 10,000 Jews just building Roman Colosseums. It says the Romans used to have something called an itstadion. What's an itstadion in modern English? A stadium. They used to set up a stadium for their entertainment, and they'd put in a lion and a Jew. And they'd say, let's see who wins. Let's see how long the Jew could stand up to the lion. A Jew and a bear. This was common entertainment for the Romans. They'd get together, like we go out to see a baseball game. They'd sit down and watch the entertainment. Two Jews on a lion, three Jews on a lion. And they'd wait to see how long they could last fighting the lion. And this was the entertainment. A lion, a bear. That's why the Mishnah says in Tractate of Ozara, you're not allowed to partake of building an itstadion. You're not allowed to have a job building a stadium, because that's something that's used to torture people to death. So this is what the Jews went through. And in spite of that, the Jewish people retained tremendous midot. We find Jews who gave up their life rather than bow down to idols, be it the story of Hannah and her seven sons. Hannah, each child is summoned before the Roman governor and told, bow down to an idol. And each one quotes another pasuk and says, I won't. And one by one they're killed. Until finally, the young son is summoned. And he answers the Roman emperor. And the Roman emperor tries to tell him, do something. And the kid says, no. And then he says, look, I'll just drop my ring. And you'll bend down to pick it up and give it to me. At least it'll look like one of you listened to me. And the child says to him, look at you. Look at you. You want me to honor you. This is what's important to you. You know what? And I'm supposed to bow to the idol. I'm doing something much more important. I'm honoring the one that counts. And he refuses. And then they take him to be executed. And Hannah runs over to him and says, When you go up there to Avraham Avinu, so tell him that he bound one son and I gave up seven. And then her seventh son is executed, and she says about herself, Ein habanim smecha. The mother of the sons can be happy because the Jewish people held on to their values. She didn't say, I lost 7 sons. She said, I merited to bring up 7 children to what I believe in. And they stood up for what we believe in. And then Hannah herself died. And we look at these stories, we have to pause and reflect. We have to realize people put up with great hardships to hold on to what we have so easily. To hold on to the ability to daven, to keep Shabbos, to circumcise their children. They didn't have it easy. We have it very easy. We're living in a golden era. And we have to value it, take advantage of it, grow with it. And remember that the Jewish people also had a golden era. This destruction came from a golden era. What destroyed the golden era was sinat chinam, baseless hatred. We have to think about it. That's what we have to fix. That means a friend of mine learns with Rabbi Nevenzahl. And he told me, Rabbi Nevenzahl always smiles to people and he's always nice to people. And he's known for his warmth. But you should know there are times when he is more warm than others. When he feels there's someone who was wrong to him, when he feels there's someone who did something wrong to him, then he goes out of his way to be more nice to him than other people. He says, let me make sure I don't have sinat chinam within me. Let me make sure that I could be extra nice to him. What's our nature? Even if we're willing to forgo it, we won't make an issue of it. But we have a hard time being nice to the person. So we have to learn to develop avat chinam. And we could end with what Rav Kook Zatzal is known as saying, if we were destroyed and the world was destroyed with us, then we should be rebuilt and the world will be rebuilt with us. If in this month our destruction came through sinat chinam, so then let us rebuild with avat chinam. We have to look for ways to be nice to a person, to like a person, to be warm to a person without good cause. We have to develop within ourselves that avat chinam. And it's something that every Jew can develop within themselves. You don't have to be the biggest tzaddik in the world. You have to realize it's important to me. Our sages say before we start Shemona Esrei, a person's supposed to think, I love every Jew. One of the ways we can connect to it is by doing the mitzvah of giving tzedakah before we daven. If we remember, I'm not just giving tzedakah before tefillah because it's an amulet. Rabbon Shom, you'll answer me now, right? I gave my tzedakah before tefillah, then it's all about me. No, before we go into davening, we're doing an act that says I'm connected to all of Am Yisrael. I'm giving tzedakah. And when I come to speak their bon shom, it's not all about me. I'm coming as a part of a greater whole. A person says that Arizal, who wants to daven, has to first connect to Am Yisrael and say, I hereby accept to love every Jewish person. And from that, go into davening and talking to their bon shom.